as the years went by, I couldn't really give up the banking money because they were right. Like, there's money in banking.
I was 20 years old, standing in the middle of the woods at 2:30 in the morning, holding nothing but a compass and a map.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to the Stoop Storytelling Series podcast. I'm Jessica Hankin.
And I'm Laura Wexler.
And this week on the podcast, Pivot Point, two stories about women who worked hard to make their parents proud and then decided to take a bit different path, which both Laura and I have kids that are about to leave the nest, as it were. Mm. And it'll be interesting.
We're just hoping they're going to take paths, right? Any road leading away. Just kidding.
All right. That's not true. We love our kids. We just would like
love them from afar.
All right. This first story is from Kim Wiggins, who shared this. Both these stories were shared at a recent Stoop event we did in partnership with Johns Hopkins Carey's Business School, Women in Business. So Kim is sharing a story about the various paths that she took. Take a listen.
I graduated from Florida A&M University with a Bachelor's of Science in Business Administration from the prestigious School of Business and Industry. My parents were proud, but what I really wanted to do was be a teacher. My seventh grade math teacher, Mr. Nagy, really helped me understand about math having rules and formulas, and it seemed great to me being in middle school that things had rules and formulas that would lead to a correct answer. But at the time when I was in high school, there were movies about that really glamorized business. So Wall Street with Michael Douglas saying greed is good. And even Eddie Murphy and Dan Aykroyd with Trading Places made the commodities market seem really, really exciting. Now, I want to pause right now because some of you out there, some of you don't even know what I'm talking about, and that's fine. But some of you may be thinking to yourself, wait, how does she even know? I'd like to say I have really, really, really great genes on my mom's side. I am older than you think I am. Don't let it distract you from this story because I have a story to tell. Okay, so got my business degree, and afterwards I stayed in Florida and became a waitress. My parents were not proud. In fact, my parents would start to introduce me during the time that I was just bouncing around in Florida, staying in beach towns, waiting tables, as this is our daughter who went to school to become a professional waitress. All right, well, that got old, and I came to my senses. And to be clear, the rounding around was because of a man. We've all been there, you know. Anyway, so I came to my senses, moved back to Maryland, and then I got a job at one of the major banks. I wound up buying a end-of-group townhouse in a lovely cul-de-sac community in Columbia, Maryland, and my parents were proud. So as the years went on, I worked at the bank, and I often thought about going into teaching, but as the years went by, I couldn't really give up the banking money because they were right. Like, there's money in banking for a job in teaching because, you know, there were no movies that were glamorizing how much money there was in teaching. And it was all about, like, somebody was teaching in the inner city and there was a lot of white savior complex going on where somebody saved one student or they saved a class and changed people's lives. But, you know, nothing ever changed the system. So I stayed in the bank, didn't go into teaching. And then in 2008, yes, I'm older than you think I am. 2008, the economy fell. The economy fell off a cliff because of mortgage-backed securities. So what did I do with the bank? Mortgage-backed securities. But it's okay because I was like, I hope I can get laid off and get this awesome severance package. And that way I can go into teaching and still have my salary from banking for months. Like, the severance package was sweet. I was like, fire me, please. But as the universe would have it, they fired two-thirds of my department. They got a severance package while they left the rest of us to do all the work that we had all done. So that was not what I was hoping of. So during the time that this was happening, I had a friend who lived in Columbia. We used to go to the Columbia gym together, do all the Columbia things, walk around the parks. But she moved to Baltimore because she was priced out of Columbia. And then she moved to Baltimore and there were people in her neighborhood that didn't have kids. And they were like the same age as her. And she went to salsa on Wednesdays and then went to Gertrude's at the BMA on Tuesday for some special they had. There's this diner called Paper Moon that she took me to that had all kinds of stuff on the wall. I'm like, can we eat here? But then we went to Belvedere Square concerts on Fridays, and it was just so great. And I was like, maybe I need to live in the city. Now, as I'm forming this plan, I'm like, I could move to the city, downsize, and then have some money to become a teacher. And then I could teach in Baltimore City because I heard they always need teachers, so I'd be easy to get a job. So this is what I was thinking. I even took the praxis, which is a test to, like, when you start it, and I passed the praxis. I was like, I'm ready to go. So, but I didn't know anything about Baltimore. So I did as people do. I Googled living in Baltimore City, and I found the organization called Live Baltimore. And Live Baltimore is a quasi-governmental agency that's also a nonprofit that promotes residential living in Baltimore by promoting its over 250 residential neighborhoods. That's the Live Baltimore spiel. So I went there, met with somebody. I said what I needed. I needed a townhouse, although in Baltimore they call them row homes. So I needed a row home that you could open the door and see all the way through, so that when I had parties, I wasn't stuck in the kitchen and people weren't crowding me in and I was in the middle of the action. I needed someplace to walk my dog because my dog loved to walk, but she was a 6-pound Yorkshire Terrier, so not a lot of protection. So I needed to be safe wherever this walking was, despite what my dog felt. And I needed a parking pad because I was not trying to mess with city parking. I had heard rumors. So that was what I was looking for. We looked at the things and decided that Patterson Park was the neighborhood for me. Yay! So then I started looking at homes. And what I found was that from block to block, the home prices would change drastically. Even when I was going out to walk and looking at open houses, like there was one time where there was like a $75,000 difference from a home that I saw that was like a small home, didn't really have recent upgrades, to this other home that I saw that was like further east of the park, but I still walked on foot. And it had wonderful upgrades. Everything was new. And it was $75,000 less than that other home that I saw. And I asked the agent, like, why, what's going on? And, you know, agents really can't tell you that it's historical racism and redlining that causes these price differences. But that's what it was, which I would find out later. But as I was looking at homes, my house actually sold because it was up for sale. It sold, and then it closed in 3 weeks. And if anybody's ever purchased a home, you're like, how can this be? The person who bought it worked for a title company. So just so you know, they can close the house faster than they say they can. So house closed in 3 weeks. I had to find someplace to live. So I wound up selling my house in Columbia and renting a row home in Baltimore City that was above the line where I should have lived. I would say that my parents were perplexed. But once I moved to Baltimore, I found my home. Immediately, I had more friends than I ever had in the county, and I just found my people. And it was great, but what I also found was, dang, Baltimore, what is going on? Why is there trash in the streets? Why are there kids out in the middle of the day? And it was, once again, what the agent couldn't tell me, it was historical racism, disinvestment in the community that has caused this situation. So I'm the kind of person that rolled up my sleeves, and I got involved in the community. I did cleanups. I managed roll-offs, which are the big trash bins that you can get. They're called roll-offs because they roll off a truck. But anyway, managed this whole process, was really, really involved in my neighborhood. And but I was still going to the bank every day. And then as time went on, I was like, oh, I felt some kind of way about working in an organization that I knew had done a lot to contribute to not only Baltimore City, but other large cities, disinvestment and blockbusting and redlining and all that. So I felt some kind of way. And then, mind you, I was renting, but then I wind up finding my house, and fun fact, did not downsize at all. But whatever, I have a awesome end of group, a corner row home is what I call it. And it has a great rooftop deck. It's awesome. But didn't downsize. But I did get this big incentive check from Obama that he was giving at the time. And then I still had proceeds from the sale of my house. So I decided to quit my job anyway. So I did that, and then I started really getting into community work. I was writing grants, I was managing grants, I was doing all kinds of projects, and I went back to waiting tables. I'm not going to comment on my parents' feelings at the time. But I did that. And during this time of doing lots of different odd things, I did wind up working at a school. So I met somebody waiting tables who managed a resource program at a school. And resources are like extracurricular activities, but during the day at school. So I managed this program, but that went away because the computers weren't working for the program that I was doing. And I was in Cherry Hill. Cherry Hill is definitely one of the starkest examples of a, you can see disinvestment for a community. In other places, it'd be this wonderful waterfront property, but history has moved all the Black people and low-income people to this area and segregated them from the city to where they had one bus line in and one bus line out. And it's just another example of how this this hurts us all. So I was in this at the school in Cherry Hill for 6 months, and what I realized is that the window for me to work with children had closed. I was not for that. I didn't know there would be a bell. No, I'm like, but I wasn't for that. So the window had closed, but also, even if I did it, I'd be like one of those 80s movies where I was just a teacher that helped a few kids, but then this whole system was broken. So a little bit after that, I saw a job posting for Live Baltimore, and it was a residential outreach manager. And I applied for it, interviewed, got the job. And what I did in that position was I helped families figure out schools and stay in the city, because part of the disinvestment in Baltimore is a loss of population. So I was able to help on that. So I was able to work with education and also help the city. And if any of you have kids and live in the city, you have probably talked to me or you know somebody who has, because I became the parent whisperer for parents to help them understand how they could live in the city. And 99% of it was schools, because people just thought all city schools are bad. But I'm a testament that there's many people who work very hard at city schools, and they have great schools, especially pre-K. So I didn't become a teacher, but in a full circle moment, as Jessica said, I now work for Baltimore City Schools, and I'm the manager of the Partnerships and Volunteers team, and by team, I mean two of us, and and we work to bring resources to our students so that you're not determined how your education is based on your zip code, and my parents are proud.
So Kim is, she's lovely, and she does so much that's just great work for the city and for Baltimore City Public Schools. So it was great to have a different set of people get to know who she is and all the good stuff that she's doing for our community.
We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll be back with one more story on today's episode.
This next story is from Stacy Lee, who also shared at the same event, and it's a story about a non-traditional traditional path, if you will. Take a listen.
I was 20 years old, standing in the middle of the woods at 2:30 in the morning, holding nothing but a compass and a map. They'd gotten me up about 40 minutes earlier, ordered me into a Humvee, drove me 25 miles into the middle of nowhere, when an Army Ranger looked at me and said, "Get out. We'll meet you in 3 hours at the extraction point." The truck door slammed, and the engine faded into the distance. I was alone. I could feel the winter wind on my face and the sound of pine needles beneath my combat boots. As I stood there, the crazy thing was, is that I had spent the past 10 years fighting to do this very thing, to prove that I was enough. This was land navigation at the United States Military Academy, a requirement that every cadet has to pass. As the daughter of a career Army officer, I wrote West Point for the first time in seventh grade. I didn't get in after high school, but I kept trying. 2 years behind my peers and one of a handful of Black women in the Corps, I arrived. I was there. That night in the woods, I thought navigation was about finding your way on a map. What I'd realize much later is that real navigation is about finding your way forward. 2 years before my junior year, it was over. You are being separated from the academy. You're no longer a cadet. No rank, no title, no career as an officer. For the first time in my life, I had absolutely no plan. With my West Point dream shattered, I needed a new path for validation. See, here's what you need to understand. I have always needed a label. Cadet, law student, litigator. So I did what was expected. I created a new path. I applied to law school. And for the first time since West Point, I felt my parents could talk about me at dinner parties again. In law school, I went through the motions. I was on a journal, did moot court, national trial team, clerked for a judge, did everything that was required to land a big job at a law firm. And you know what? It worked. After law school, I went to work as a securities litigator at a big firm. But every once in a while, I'd hear a voice in the back of my head. Is this all there is? But I'd quickly silence that because questioning the path wasn't part of the plan. In fact, after West Point, law school, and while practicing, I got really good at silencing any voice that asked, are you finding this fulfilling? Wait, fulfillment? That's not what the path is about. The path is about validation. And work is called work for a reason, right? I remember after a case, we were still in the courtroom and everyone was celebrating. And the excitement or thrill that I thought I should feel wasn't there. I wasn't unhappy. I was on autopilot. And I'd stay that way for the next 10 years. Until I saw it. The unexpected exit sign on the highway of my life. It came in the form of an ad in the Daily Record for an adjunct business law professor. For some reason, teaching resonated with a part of me that I had been keeping silent. Without overthinking it, I applied for the job, and I got it. Then it happened. The spark. When I walked into the classroom, a student asked me a question that really made me stop and think. And in answering her question, I engaged with the law in a new way. Instead of bending it to serve a bottom line or a client's wishes, I found myself with students exploring it, questioning it, debating it. I got to teach it. I had spent years arguing in courtrooms. In the classroom, I got to have a conversation. Something inside me shifted. By the end of the semester, I knew I had a problem. In the classroom, I wasn't on autopilot. I was alive. But that meant choosing a road or leaving a road that I had spent my whole entire professional career building. It meant leaving the salary, the prestige, the title. My mentor called me into his office and he said, hey, this teaching thing, do it on the side, but don't stop practicing. You spent your entire career working to get where you are right now. Why in the world would you walk away from that? You didn't go to law school to teach. I went home that night, and for the first time, I knew I would make a decision based on fulfillment, not validation. I've been teaching for 16 years. I have never walked into the classroom without feeling better when I left than when I walked in. Never. That night in the woods at West Point, I thought navigation was about following a predetermined path. I spent the bulk of my life thinking success meant finding the hardest, most prestigious thing that I could find. I thought that the path of validation meant proving I belonged. I was good enough, smart enough, successful enough. What I learned is that the road less traveled isn't always the hardest road. Sometimes it's the road that's right in front of you, but you can't see because you're too focused, striving to prove yourself on the road that you think everyone else values. Navigation isn't about forcing yourself to stay on the most difficult road. It's about having the courage to look up from the map that you've been handed and find the path that is true. For me, that meant charting a course without precedent, without certainty. Was it scary? Oh, yeah. But it was also liberating. Because on this road, the road that I didn't plan for, I wake up every morning knowing that I am where I'm supposed to be. Thank you.
The beginning of this story is so captivating. And she, when I was talking to her and getting to know her through the process, just all of her stories about being at West Point were, she loved her experience there, but also found it incredibly challenging, of course, to be a woman of color in that setting. And she doesn't, that's not the only issue. She just says it's a complicated place in general. But I think she got out of her experience. But she is one of the most beloved teachers at that school. I mean, the students just adore her. So there's no question that she seems very fulfilled by the path that she found herself on.
And we are very fulfilled by the path that we have found ourselves in this podcast. And doing the stoop for all these years. And thank you for listening to this week's episode. We want to thank Maureen Harvey for producing the podcast. And hey, check out our website at stoopstorytelling.com. There you're going to find information about all of our programs, including a show on May 8th at the Creative Alliance. And also you can listen to every story we've ever recorded there at the website. You can find us on Facebook and Instagram at Stoop Storytelling. See you next week. Thank you.